National media continues to exaggerate and promote misleading negative headlines designed to diminish the rule of law and those whose job it is to enforce it. Remember, the only people who want to defund the police and dismantle these agencies are the criminals. And don't forget to thank a cop. Now, let's start the show. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We've got several people today. First on our list of guests is ASAC Polo from DEA. He's the assistant special agent in charge. Good morning, Polo. How are you?
Good morning, Sherry. Very good. And yourself?
Doing great. I understand we have a take-back day. Explain to our listeners what that is and how they can take part in it.
Yes, good morning. Sherry, I'm honored to be on your radio show this morning, relaying this important message on take-back. We're hosting the 25th National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on today's date. It's a no-cost opportunity for the community to anonymously dispose of unneeded, expired medications, and it's throughout Arizona, not only in Arizona, but also nationally. We have about 5,000 local drop-off locations nationally, and within Arizona, we have 80. Here in southern Arizona, we have 22.
So if people go to, if you want to know where one of these locations is, if you go to www.deatakeback.com, it'll give you a list of where the locations are. And I know a lot of the police departments do it year-round. They'll have a container in their lobby, don't they?
Yes, as a matter of fact, yes. Actually, one of your guest speakers, Chief Nolan, at the Sawatit Police Department, they have one there, but they're, as you mentioned, www.deatakeback.com is one of the locations. And if people cannot bring them on this particular day, throughout the year, we have them at the hospitals, clinics, police departments, everywhere we can, but we try to do it all in twice a year. Last April, actually, the other take-back day, and that's where we were able to pick up over 7,475 pounds of unused medication. Yeah, and, you know, this is important for all of us, especially right now we're fighting the fentanyl epidemic. We have over 110,000 people that have died, unfortunately, through overdoses, and some of them are accidentals. And what's been happening is that folks like you and I, when we go to our doctor, we get a prescription medicine, and we may not consume all of it if we're ill. And then what happens, it ends up in your medicine cabinet. Then other family members end up utilizing and consuming or taking those prescription meds over to the schools, you know, to the high schools or even middle schools, and then they start interchanging them there. And now then they end up becoming addicts to it. Once they find that they cannot get any more of those pills, they start going in the black market on the streets. And that's where we have this epidemic where the drug cartels from across the border are manufacturing these fake oxys. But then on top of that, then now they're making them into different color variations, red, blue, green, purples, pinks, you know, it lures our young children to think that this is like candy. But in all reality, you're playing Russian roulette with your life.
Have you ever had anybody who sells these illegal drugs drop stuff off on a take-back day?
Oh, believe it or not, we have had some. We've had, yes, we have had some folks. But for us, this is something that we do not, we're not here after the addict. Our main priority is to take back these drugs.
And get them off the street.
This is that's correct. And this is an anonymous form to turn them in. We will ask no questions when somebody brings them in. we would just take them in, and then from there dispose of them the way they're supposed to be disposed of. Now, we do have some things that we do ask because of the fact that we will not accept syringes, sharps, and or if it's an illicit drug, then we'll book it differently. But what we do take is at the collection sites, the tablets, capsules, and patches, vapes as well. But of course, the lithium batteries need to be removed because eventually, within a week's time frame, once we do all the collection throughout Arizona, we all of us team up, and then we take it to a location to properly dispose. But of course, you know, we end up burning all that stuff, and it's no joke when you got lithium batteries in there, and that's why we have all these different things. We have all these little precautions that we end up taking because they end up popping out. And
I was going to say that takes the excitement out of it, doesn't it?
That's correct, sir. But and then another thing is, Sherry, that we're facing is all fentanyl all illicit drugs that are seized. You know, we analyze them, but more specifically, fentanyl. Right now, it used to be several months ago, 4 out of the 10 pills was a lethal dose. Now we have through analysis throughout the country. And through all our laboratories that we end up analyzing fentanyl seizures, 7 out of 10 pills is found to be a lethal dose.
Wow.
So 2 milligrams. And I try to explain it this way because a lot of people say, well, what's 2 milligrams? They really don't know. But if you were to get a sugar packet, for instance, and you put 18 granules of small little granules of sugar on the table, that is enough for lethal dose.
And kill
unfortunately
you.
That would kill you. And that's where, you know, and I'm sure your guests and specifically Mr. Nolan gets phone calls from, you know, from parents and from cousins and everybody just worried about this thing going on. I get calls all the time at the office because the fact that you know, their son or daughter died. And this week, actually, we just kicked off the Red Ribbon Week, and you know, to celebrate and pay homage to a drug enforcement agent that got kidnapped, tortured, and killed down in Guadalajara, Mexico, back in 1985. But of course, it sparked the drug awareness and to just say the no to drugs.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Paulo, and explaining all this to us. And if you have anything laying around the house that you don't want, take it down and get it disposed of properly. So appreciate you calling in. You have a good weekend.
Great. Likewise, ma'am. Thank you very much. It's an honor.
Okay, take care, Paulo. Okay, our next guest is Hal Kempfer. He is the CEO of Global Risk Intelligence Planning. And I have a question for you, Hal. Yeah. Iran and China keep poking at us like they, you know, like they're being bullies. They're trying to instigate something. What's going on with that?
China's poking and bullying, huh?
Yeah.
Well, they've got some bizarre claims, and basically they're what we call hegemons. They're pushing their boundaries. They have a, you know, they if you look at where they were say 30 years ago and where they are today. Their economy has grown leaps and bounds. Their global presence has grown leaps and bounds. And under Xi, particularly, which kind of surprised a lot of people, nobody really, I got to tell you, a lot of people did not see this coming when Xi took over. They thought he was going to be kind of in the same mold of his predecessors, where they wanted to grow the economy, but they weren't going to take all the political stuff. He went a different direction, and he has poured a tremendous amount of money into the military. He's did this thing, and you know, I do a lot of work in maritime security under a special Department of Defense initiative where I go all over the world, but I spend a lot of time over in Asia as well, and we work with our foreign partners out there. So we've been watching this for quite some time, but they took a bunch of Navy ships, painted them white, and called them Coast Guard, right? It was a little bit of a deception thing because they go, oh, it's Coast Guard, right? And everybody loves the Coast Guard because they do search and rescue and all that stuff. Not this Coast Guard. This Coast Guard goes in there, and as we saw this last week, they ram Philippine boats and stuff. This is a very aggressive Coast Guard. And with that, they also have this all these other, what we would call civilian ships. It's a kind of a civilian, I'm using the term loosely when we talk about anything out of the People's Republic of China, but it's called the Maritime Militia. And basically, it's a way to mobilize all their ships out there into something that works for the government, if you will. And they have this claim through the South China Sea, which basically is they claim the South China Sea. It's called the nine-dash line claim that cuts into everybody's exclusive economic zones, Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, all across the board. And, of course, the International Court said, no. There is absolutely no basis under the UN Convention Law of the Sea where you can make that claim. And China's like, yeah, okay, whatever. We're just going to keep doing it. That's what China's been doing. That's what we saw this last week. And we also saw this thing with the and with that, they've been doing very aggressive things at sea. But this last week, of course, we saw they had a fighter jet fly within 10 feet of not just a U.S. plane. We've had some very close calls. In fact, if you go back 20 years, one of the fighter jets actually hit one of our planes, and our plane had to make an emergency landing. Their plane didn't make it at all, but our plane made an emergency landing. But they flew within 10 feet of a B-52 bomber.
Wow.
And the thing on that is, to say reckless doesn't really describe how stupid that is. By the way, their pilots aren't that good either. That's another issue. But to fly next to a strategic bomber, you know, this is what we carry nuclear weapons in. I'm not saying that bomber had nuclear weapons. In fact, I'm pretty sure it did not. But to fly that close to one of our strategic bombers, if there had been a mishap in the air, you can imagine how that could have escalated very quickly.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, so that's... we could spend hours, but I go all over the world, Africa, South Asia, all over, and they got that Belt and Road Initiative where they basically go in there and says, hey, we'll build this for you, and the countries go, great, and then they say, oh, you're going to build a road or a railroad, they do it, and when they get done, they bring in all Chinese labor out of China, they build the railroad, and they say, okay, and by the way, here's your bill, and they have what they call it like a $1.1 or $1.2 trillion debt bomb in China because they got these usurious loans to all these countries around the world. And some of the countries have simply said, we can't pay it back. It's impossible. And in some cases, the countries actually changed government and they realized that the previous regime that they just kicked out had secretly sign these notes to China. They go, you basically have made our country, you know,
indebted
to China. Yeah. So they're, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, they're being very aggressive, but then again, you know, they got that problem where literally $1 trillion worth of loans could evaporate, which would cause massive ramifications in China, obviously. And then they got their own internal problem with their financial problems with all the massive building that they did, and now they got this real estate crisis, and another major real estate development firm basically went bankrupt this last week. And so a lot of these things that everybody was sitting there in awe, you know, 10, 15 years ago, saying, wow, look at this, they're building like four, you know, huge cities every 3 years or something. Well, those huge cities got built, nobody moved into them, they're all empty. So now they got this massive real estate thing, which literally could tip the economy. And so everybody's kind of wondering,
where is this going?
So Xi's doing a lot of stuff where he's, you know, what they're doing is externalizing internal pressures, which is, you know, China or Taiwan, all that stuff, to basically get everybody's attention away from the fact that they've completely mismanaged the economy and it might collapse. A little minor point. So, yeah.
That wouldn't break my heart. What about Iran? Oh. What's Iran doing?
They may have been behind. You know, we don't know. You know, they are the major backer of Hamas with the And whereas we've said we don't have any evidence of that Iran was the orchestrator of the October 7th attack, it really defies logic that they didn't know all about it. And there was that Wall Street Journal article based on some source that said that they had a meeting before the attack and that Iran literally green-lit doing that attack. And, of course, since the attack, not just what's happening with Hamas, but you got Hezbollah doing stuff on the northern border. It has not weighed in completely. It hasn't crossed what the Israelis say is a red line in terms of their operational tempo up there. But a lot of back and forth shooting, you know, there's been deaths on both sides with that. And the worry is that Hezbollah, which is much, much larger than Hamas, would weigh in as a second front in Israel. But then we see across the board, you know, attacks on our installations in Syria and Iraq, to include a base where I was stationed, you know, way back when. And also the Houthi rebels that are down in Yemen along the Red Sea, across the very strategic Bab el-Mandeb Straits, launched cruise missiles and drones that were targeting Israel. And I have to tell you, a lot of us got looking, really? The Houthi rebels can launch a cruise missile and a drone that can get all the way up to Israel? That was actually, I don't know if they would have made it. I don't know where they would have actually ended up. But the fact that these Houthi rebels had that type of capability was somewhat stunning. Fortunately, we had a cruiser right there, and we shot those down. But it gives you an idea of how Iran is kind of pushing with all of its proxy terror groups and insurgent groups across the region. Now, we shot down those missiles in the Red Sea. Yesterday, we did airstrikes on facilities tied to the Shiite extremist terrorist group that launched attacks on our bases, which is controlled by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC. And those are pretty big airstrikes, from what I understand. So we're responding in kind with these things. But that's Iran. They're trying to push it. Now, it could be very possible that, you know, they had this big plan that Hamas would do this in the south, Hezbollah would open up in the north, and then all these other groups would attack U.S. installations, and there would be this big war in the Middle East. And then there's hypothetically that maybe, let's just say theoretically, that Iran was close to Russia. Let's just say hypothetically they had a relationship, you know, such as Iran shipping all those drones up to fight the war in Ukraine, right? And that Russia would love to see something in the Middle East that would draw ammunition and weapons that would go to Ukraine. Instead, they go to Israel, which is kind of what's happening, all right? And then to go back to your first question about China, the other hypothesis is that, and China would love to see the U.S. bogged down supporting a major war in Europe, bogged down actually involved with a major war in the Middle East before they do something in the West Pacific. That's what strategists are looking at. That's what they're saying. You can't prove it. Maybe somewhere they've got some super, you know, top secret, you know, stuff that says, yep, this is the big plan, but that's the hypothesis. Regardless of that, you have to look at that anyway, because those opportunities for China are presenting themselves, and weapons and ammunition is getting diverted to Israel that probably would have gone to Ukraine. So,
well, as long as we're not sleeping at the wheel, because I just look at everything that's going on and listening to you and listening to some of the news, it's like, okay, hopefully we're awake and we don't have another Pearl Harbor, because it just seems like they're doing things that are setting everything up to get uglier. Yes. It's ugly, but it's uglier.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. You know, the other side of this, though, I guess in my world, this is the bright side, I guess. The other side is that Russian troops are refusing orders on the line.
Well, I can't blame them. I certainly can't blame them.
Well, what's happening is they're being executed.
Oh no!
So that was something that John Kirby talked about yesterday at a press conference, is that they're shooting their own troops and they're threatening to shoot, and they may already be doing it, shooting entire units.
Oh my God. I mean,
this goes back to like Roman legions with the concept of decimate a unit.
Yeah.
And so, don't know. I mean, I say that may be the bright side in that finally the Russian troops are having enough. We're just kind of wondering how bad was it going to get? Bad leadership, bad logistics, bad equipment, bad tactics, bad everything before the Russian troops had it. And that gets back to that idea that we might be looking at 1917 again, where the Russian troops literally stood up and killed their officers and marched on Moscow. I'm not going to be that optimistic that the Russian troops are all going to do that, but we're seeing some cracks and fissures in their overall cohesion, if you will. And we'll see how far that goes. So,
well, hopefully things will get better, you know, mm-hmm. somehow. And I appreciate you calling in and giving us an update on what's happening over there. You watch the news and you just start putting pieces together and it's like, oh my God, what are we doing and why?
Oh, yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah.
So you have a good weekend and we'll stay in touch because I want to know what's going on.
Okay. You too, Sherry. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Take care. Okay. In the studio, we have Chief John Nolan of Sahuarita. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Sherry.
And we've got a whole list of stuff to talk about. But first thing, I think everybody needs to know you're hiring, right?
Yes, we are. We're hiring police officers.
And what's the process? What do people have to do if they're interested?
And I should say we're also hiring community service officers. Those are people that deal with certain types of policing incidents. They're civilians. They do wear a uniform. And they can provide everything from traffic control aid to officers and deal with smaller incidents. But, we're hiring police officers and looking for well-qualified people.
Okay, a community service officer doesn't carry a gun?
They do not. They actually, for us, they do carry a taser for self-protection. They do or can carry pepper spray for self-protection as well. But they do... traffic control, they'll take a crime report with very few leads, with no active suspect on scene, etc. They'll also do animal control duties as well. So a very good position. And we have two of those openings right now. We've got some testing in process, but if people are interested, please go online to our town HR department and you'll find the ability to apply there.
Okay, so if you're a community service person, you don't have to run a mile carrying a 50-pound bag of something, and you don't have to do 1,000 push-ups in 20 minutes.
Great, great point. No, this is all internal training. We do training internally for a number of weeks, but there is the physical standard is basically a medical exam you take when you're in the testing process, but you don't have to jump a wall, climb a fence, do a body drag, any of that type of stuff.
Okay. Do you have your own, when you call 911 communication center, when people call 911, do they call you?
No, you do not. You call the sheriff's department.
Okay.
And they dispatch for us through a contract.
Okay. So are you hiring dispatchers too, or do you know?
No. So we wouldn't have our own dispatchers. That would be done through the county, through our contract.
Okay. Tell me about your law enforcement. Is it, what do you have to do to be law enforcement and carry the gun other than be a good shot?
Yeah, well, a good shot is important,
yeah.
But there are several other things. So you have to go through our testing process, which has multiple phases or stages. So you have to do the POPAT, Police Officer Physical Aptitude Test, POPAT. That's required through AZ Post. Okay. That obviously certifies officers in the state of Arizona. And that includes being able to get over a 6-foot wall, climb and or scale a 6-foot fence. You do a short run up to that wall and fence and then a 25-yard run after that. You have to do a body drag, 165-pound body drag.
165-pound?
Yeah, so you pick up a 165-pound body and drag it, or you can grab it and drag it, hence the word drag. So you can grab it by an arm, a leg, and simply drag it the required distance.
You should use real people and see how that works out.
No, we use the dummy.
We use the dummy. So, okay, how many officers are you looking to hire?
We are 60 sworn, and we have a number of them in training right now, either FTO, Fuel Training Officer Program. We have a number in the academy. I think we have three in two different academies right now. So they're technically hired, which reduces the number we are able to hire, the FTE or full-time employee equivalent. However, I think we're about six down right now. So we're looking to hire at least six police officers.
Okay. Once they're hired and they go through all this training, how do you separate them out? Different specialties? Do you have canine people?
So we have right now, you go through the academy, then you go through what we refer to as post-basic, which is about 3 to 4 weeks long. And then you go through the FTO program.
Which is?
Field Training Officer Program.
Okay.
And then you become a solo police officer. So that takes about a year, 5 months of an academy, a solid 4 months of FTO. And this is for a brand new officer, not a lateral transfer. And then the testing process at both ends takes about an additional 3 months. So roughly about a year. But you're being paid during that time as well. So as a trainee, we have special assignments, collateral duties, etc. So we have detectives, if that's what you're interested in. We have school resource officers. We have traffic officers. Some people call them traffic DUI officers. And so those special assignments are available to people. Those are examples. And then we have collateral duties, everything from UAV robotics, where they operate drones, and robotic dogs that we recently got into here in the last year or so.
You have a robotic dog?
We have robotic dogs, plural, yes. And they're actually very useful. We actually have sent them on actual calls for barricaded subjects. The dog is enters the home, and it gives us live eyes and ears on what is happening in the home. So an officer doesn't necessarily have to turn the corner, go into the room. We can send the robot in.
Okay, I know you have to have a pilot's license to operate a drone. What kind of license do you have to operate a dog?
It's typically no license. It is vendor training, so you buy it from a particular vendor, and then we have them trained. So right now, because they're so closely aligned, we use our UAV operators or pilots and robotic operators at the same people. That they have the skill set in both.
So do these dogs bark or anything?
They can deliver a communication device, such as a cell phone, drop phone, etc. They're very useful.
I want one of those.
And they don't make a mess in the house.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. No food, no mess in the house. That would be awesome. So do you have real dogs?
We have comfort dogs currently. We're looking at training the comfort dogs to do stuff by scent, such as sniffing for electronics. They would be able to aid for on search warrants, things of that nature. We're not there yet, but that's what we're examining. And I recently had a discussion, actually this last week, with our FOP, the Union for Officers, about trying to push forward a traditional canine program. And so we would realistically try to start off with two canine handlers, two canines, the vehicles that are equipped, et cetera. So in my former career out of California, as a lieutenant, I supervised and ran the canine program there. And so I'm familiar with what it takes to put one of those programs together. And I, the FOP, as well as all of our command staff, want to see this pushed forward. So we'd like to accelerate that.
So where would you get the dogs? Who would train the dogs?
So we would probably reach out to allied agencies and see where they are currently purchasing their police canines. But there are a number of organizations that will sell or provide a dog to us that is applicable for that type of police work.
So what kind of dog are you thinking of? The Malinois?
I know Belgian Malinois are good police dogs. Some shepherds, depending on their line, are still good police dogs. But I haven't come to a decision. I think we'd have a discussion amongst command staff and the number of officers that may have skill sets in that area, and maybe even call in some allied agencies and see what they're currently using that is successful.
Last week was the canine trials up in Scottsdale. Did you go?
I unfortunately wasn't able to go to that.
It was pretty spectacular. You watched all these handlers, and they came from all over the country doing what they do best, and it was pretty impressive. You know,
the dogs are amazing animals. They can do fantastic stuff, and they're clearly loyal to their handlers.
Oh, absolutely. You could tell. They didn't leave their sides, though. Okay, what else do we have going on there? You're recruiting people. Let's talk about the bail system, the no bail system. How is this affecting Sahuarita?
So it's impacting us. I refer to this as no bail, low bail. And I've written some articles in our annual report connected to this for the police department. I'm not a proponent of this no bail, low bail. I mean, not a proponent of it at all. It eliminates responsibility and accountability mm-hmm. of those where clear probable cause has been established to make the arrest. And we are having people that are being released on a number of crimes, to include some crimes of violence or threatened violence and repetitive theft, repetitive vandalism, and a variety of other crimes where they are let go within an hour of being booked or dropped off at the county jail. So we have recently gone to a process where we are implementing a SPD recommended bail schedule. And so our officers will be trained on this here in the next few to several weeks. And it is a way to give a recommended bail to the judge at initial appearance with an explanation on why that amount of bail is being recommended. So sometimes it's because it's a crime of violence, or the person has been arrested a number of times over a number of years, or the person is repeating misdemeanor crimes. So I want to make this point, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. It is not just crimes of violence or threatened violence. It is the misdemeanor crimes, the F6, the lowest grade of felony crimes, the F5s, etc., that continue to plague our and other communities here in our area in Pima County. And bail requires commitment. It's skin in the game by the person who's arrested to behave, because I can point to a number of cases, dozens and dozens and dozens of cases in our own town where people are being released and they go back out and they reoffend, sometimes the same crime or a different crime. And I believe that should be taken into account by the judge who's making the decision on whether or not bail is applied or not.
Oh, absolutely. It's gotten to the point where we've got people flying in from other countries so they can rob people and steal, and they ship their goods back to where they came from. And that's the reputation we have now with this bail reform that I think has totally failed. We need to take a quick break. I've lost track of time here. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a few.
This is JL reminding you the City of Tucson election is vote by mail only. Ballots will be mailed October 11th. Please look for your ballot, fill it out, and drop it in the mail by October 31st. In-person ballot drop-off locations are listed on the County Recorder's website. Let your voice be heard. Vote for a cleaner, safer Tucson.
You don't need to own a gun to make sure your children are trained and know what to do if they come across one. For the past 20 years, the folks at Diamondback have taught firearm safety and concealed weapon permit classes. Hi, I'm Ben Anderson, Director of Training at Diamondback Shooting Sports. Sign up for a class today at dbacktraining.com so you can be prepared for the unexpected. We're open 7 days a week, so stop in and introduce yourself. We're located in the Gaslight Plaza at the southwest corner of Broadway and Kolb on Tucson's east side.
LawMatters1030.org is a nonprofit that needs your support in El Tour de Tucson, either by riding a bike or walking in the 5K. To support us while we support law enforcement, please go to LawMatters1030.org support page to sign up. We'll see you there.
The Cochise County Sheriff's Office is hiring detention officers. You must be 18 years old and have a high school diploma or GED. Starting salary is $40,000 a year, plus health benefits and retirement. Deputies must be 21 years old, so this is a great opportunity to start your law enforcement career at 18 and then apply to be a deputy at 21. To apply, visit cochise.az.gov. Start your career as a detention officer at the Cochise County Sheriff's Office. Visit cochise.az.gov.
Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Chief Nolan from Sava Rita, and we were just talking about bail reform, what they refer to as bail reform. And basically, it's like no bail. You can go out and do what you want to do, and you'll be back on the street in no time at all. Do you think this is because of the prosecutors or the judges that are hearing the cases, or a combination? Why are these people just, it's a free-for-all. Why is this happening?
It's rarely one thing. So I believe it's a combination. I believe prosecutors are being given direction. Prosecutors have beliefs on whether or not bail should be applied. I think the same thing is true of the court system. And I'm pretty clear on reading ARS statutes that there are strict guidelines on bail. But it does not say they automatically get out of jail or a booking without bail. They need to take certain things into consideration. And one of the most important portions of that is a danger to community, danger to others. And there's more than one type of danger. So on a physical, I'm sorry, on a violent crime, there's the person that shot at somebody or tried to stab somebody or tried to stab somebody. And then there's the lesser violent ones, if I put it that way, where somebody has punched, striked, kicked somebody. So you have to evaluate those carefully. How much of a danger are they if they are released from custody? And the statute doesn't talk about just physical violence or just violence being a danger. There are other types of dangers to a community. A store that gets shoplifted time and time again. A place that gets vandalized over and over. Simple misdemeanor crimes, which are quality of life crimes, which are the majority of our calls for service. They're the majority of crimes. So felonies happen with lesser frequency than misdemeanors. So from my perspective, it's very clear that if somebody is having their home burglarized, technically a property crime, but that's your castle. That's where you live. You want security there. And somebody looks at that solely as a prosecutor, a judge looks at that solely as a property crime. From my perspective, it's not. And clearly from the victim's perspective, it's not. You invaded my space. Well, this is true of organized retail crime, where people do this as a living.
Yes.
They steal, and sometimes they steal small amounts and other times large amounts. So we've had people steal anywhere from $27 to $2,700 and different numbers, larger amounts even. And so our goal at Sawarita, you'll go into our police department, you'll see it on just about every wall throughout the police department. Quality is job one. Yes, I did take that from Ford. But the idea behind that quality is job one is we do a quality investigation. We document it appropriately in a good report. And then we let the prosecutors make the decisions on how far they take that case. But my philosophy and my directive to my staff, in particular, if it's a crime of violence or threatened violence, we enforce the law. When we develop probable cause, we enforce the law on a crime of violence or threatened violence. This is geared towards the last 2 years, finding out that our youngest school shooter in U.S. history was 6 years old. He came to school and shot their teacher. And our oldest now, I believe, mass shooter was 73 years old. I might be off by a year or two on that. So the template or the idea of what people look like and who's going to commit the crime is done. And what is required is accountability. So that quality investigation, that quality report that tells the story will help inform prosecutors, courts, etc., on holding them accountable.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing that's missing today is accountability for your actions, whether it's verbal or physical. You know, people just don't want to be accountable. They just run amok. This is wrong.
Very true. And if you've got this no bail, low bail approach, do people like you? Is everybody a victim? So there's no or little prosecution in certain areas of the law, then people like you because you're not being held accountable. But people do need accountability. I mean, it's drug dealing. Drug dealing's bad. It's horrible. It's a felony. It impacts communities. It kills people. But there are no drug dealers without those people purchasing it. So somewhere there's a solution out there where
hold
there's
them
some,
both accountable.
Where there's some level of accountability for those people in possession of drugs, and there's clearly accountability for those people that are selling drugs.
And using.
Yes. Yeah. And using.
I've heard people say, you know, my child doesn't use drugs, he just sells them. I said, oh, that makes it all right. Hello.
Wow.
Don't tell me that. So, okay. I could talk on this topic forever because it's so frustrating, but I've heard people say, you know, well, they're just using drugs and it's a victimless crime. When you look at all the retailers that are being robbed so that they can support that victimless crime, there's an issue here. There's victims everywhere.
Yeah, it's not even close to victimless. One, when we let somebody use drugs, I mean, I think California's gone the 180 degrees the wrong direction with taking possession of heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, etc., and going from simple possession as a felony to a misdemeanor. And now officers, a number of them, don't even enforce it anymore because there's no accountability to it. But the idea that it is victimless is incorrect. So when people are using drugs, they're harder to employ. This is just one example. They're harder to employ. When they're not employed, they're not making money or as much money. So they go to other means to obtain everything from food, but jackets, devices, etc. So we found people that are using drugs that are not just stealing to prevent them from starving to death. That's really not occurring out there. They're stealing, and they're stealing all sorts of stuff, rollouts from large stores now, shopping carts full of stuff, and they will roll out with that, and it's $500 worth, $1,000 worth, $2,000 worth, etc. These are significant losses for the store, which is not a victimless crime.
No, and we've got stores closing because of it.
Correct. And then they are selling those products online, in person, etc., and trading them for more drugs.
Yeah.
So it's not victimless. There's a cycle in there. And this is what I mean by the person who is simply a user or a possessor, there must be some level of accountability. That means some time in a county jail, a facility. I'm not anti-treatment. If somebody needs treatment, let's work to get them treatment. But I want truly evidence-based programs that will help them get off the habit or the addiction of using a particular type of drug. And I see or I hear about different programs that claim to be evidence-based, and they're anything but. Their success rate is minuscule. So it's not 90% success. It's not 50% success. It's not 25% success. But we're pouring so much money into these, I guess with a hope, but as I have said for years, hope is a boat that don't float a lot of the time. So it can't be done by hope. You've got to be able to show success in these programs since we're spending primarily taxpayer money on these programs.
Yeah, and we need to find a better way of doing what we're doing. Let's go back to the old way of doing things. Hold people accountable. You're selling drugs, you're going to jail. You're using drugs, you're going to jail. You're robbing a store or stealing from a store, or like you said, the rollout, you're going to jail. But they've made it really easy here in Tucson because all the buses are like free. So you can go rob a place, jump on a bus and leave. And, you know, you're gone. By the time police get there, you're history. So let's talk about, you know, this has to have an impact on the mental capacity for, you know, your people. How do they feel when they're working to help people, you know, keep the community safe, and these people are just let go constantly? It's like, that has to be frustrating.
Yeah, I was going to use that F word as well, frustrating. So it is frustrating. There's a lot more that officers do than when I started back in 1984. So it's much different. The vehicles are different. The equipment is different. The statutes are different. The way you enforce and what is expected by our police officers now is much different than it was in the 80s, the 90s, yeah, the 2000s, etc. So it changes on a regular basis. And so it has a toll on our officers. And right now we are implementing, it's in progress, a variety of steps, sort of a multi-pronged process or approach, rather, to officer well-being. So we're actually utilizing one app off a smartphone for officers right now. And we put this in effect probably about 2 months ago. And there are several of our officers utilizing the app, and then they're providing us positive feedback on it being successful to address certain things connected to their wellness. So it can be physical wellness, it can be mental health, etc. So myself, I wouldn't have thought an application, it would not be something I would go to. I'm from a different time period a little bit, but I'm still currently working, so I understand it. But some of those apps work. So we have one that we've put in place. We're now experimenting with a second application. We also have a new vendor that we've made contact with that has helped us come in and provide critical incident stress debriefings, or CISMs now as they're calling it, and a professional that deals with law enforcement specifically comes in to a group of officers and goes over a critical incident. We had this recently for a juvenile that committed suicide, and the officers had to deal with it when the parents were home, etc. So clearly devastating impact, and I feel for that family. Yeah. But I also feel for my officers. So we got positive feedback on that. So that's sort of that second prong. We now have this professional group of people that can come out and go through that process with the officers on what they experienced and perhaps what they may continue to experience in days or weeks or time periods to come. So that's beneficial for us. And we've also made an improvement in our one-to-one counseling. I'm blessed by having a town council, Mayor Murphy, Vice Mayor Egbert, and all of our council members who actually listen to me, listen to our manager, our assistant manager, and I'm blessed by having our current manager and assistant manager who will listen to needs and then make decisions after contemplating what I provide as far as advice or desired resources, etc. So we have the ability to have one-on-one counseling now, and it's for a lot longer period of time. Used to get, like, I don't know, 12 sessions, and now you get easily twice that many or three times that many, and then the request can be made, I still need additional sessions in anything from therapy to counseling to I just need somebody to talk to, that type of stuff. So that's sort of our three-prong approach right now in officer wellness, and I'm going to put a shout out to both my commanders who have pushed this for us. Commander Allred and Commander Amato have pushed this, and if all my staff, all my officers and managers don't know, they've been a driving force behind this. So the kudos should go to both those commanders for pushing this forward, as well as some others. And those resources for wellness are available to our civilian or professional staff as well.
Now, we were talking about that search and rescue, and this was brought up a while back, where one of the trainees had never seen a dead body. And I wouldn't have thought of that. Just, you know, if you've never seen it, it's kind of shocking, and it can have an impact on you. Do you have your resource officer, not your resource officers, your community people, are they trained in situations like that where, you know, they come up to a bad situation and there's a body there? Are they trained to how to handle that?
Yes, we give them training. So our community service officers could come upon a fatal traffic collision, a pedestrian struck, that type of stuff, a body found. So they may have to assist with some of that. They're not going to be touching or manipulating the body or anything like that. But our civilian staff, our crime scene specialists, which most people think of as CSI, our crime scene specialists, they're all civilians. They go to the autopsies, they take the photographs, all that type of stuff. So we do provide training for that. We have sent people, just in a general sense, but specifically to dealing with homicides and things of that nature, to schools all over the United States. I often say we're not LAPD and we're not NYPD. We're in between, but don't confuse us with Podunk PD. We're not Mayberry. So we're somewhat sophisticated. We're always willing to learn from other agencies. And quite frankly, we utilize success stories from other agencies. And sometimes we're providing the success story because we're pushing on technology, such as Sahuarita PD was the first agency in the state of Arizona with a licensed UAV program. And others have reached out to us from Oro Valley, Marana, et cetera, to implement theirs. How did you guys start that? So they did the work at their end, but we were able to guide them to some of the answers to start their own programs.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no, so your programs for the mental health and wellness are available to all your employees?
Every employee.
Okay, that's what I was kind of trying to figure out. Okay, that's very cool. Do you have a problem with the people coming over the border?
We do. So we have a contract. We have a grant that we connect with, Operation Stone Garden. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. We're thankful for that grant. Obviously, it's a federal program run through the state of Arizona. We apply for it each year. We've been fortunate to receive it each year. And we use those for operational patrols, both in the town of Sahuarita and a large envelope outside the town of Sahuarita. So it's possible people will see marked Sahuarita police units and officers well outside our traditional jurisdictional area, because we work with Border Patrol to find those that are trafficking in people. Goes back to sex crimes and a variety of other crimes that they traffic people for.
Human trafficking, yeah.
Yep. And drugs and obviously weapons. So those are the three primary things that we're out there working on. And so most of our contacts, we contact Border Patrol and we turn them over to Border Patrol. But we've had incidents where we call Border Patrol, and because they're so busy doing other duties now, that they say, we can't respond, let them go.
Yeah.
And as a law enforcement agency, we have to follow the law, and our process, policy and law requires certain things. So we'll do what the law says.
Okay, we only have 2 minutes left. What is your solution for the border? I mean, you know, we've obviously got a situation with the border. Can you sum it up in 2 minutes?
Again, it's a multi-pronged approach.
Yes.
It's also the policy of elected officials from the president on down and what they're going to do to approach this. But we have people walking over in lines in the hundreds, and I think we've had a few cases where thousands have walked over at one time. So our elected leaders need to, especially at the upper end of government, the federal government, need to look at some different approaches and what they're currently doing. It's not working, in my opinion, as an individual who lives in Sahuarita, as well as the local police chief there, seeing what my officers are going through and the number of people that are crossing, claiming asylum, and then moving into all sorts of locations throughout the U.S. There's not a lot of background process going through on there. And some of the countries they're coming from, even if we had the personnel to do backgrounds on them, you're not going to be able to get that. They don't have the systems. They don't have the criminal justice systems. They don't have the databases, et cetera, that more developed countries have.
And may not even allow you to have that information because you're a different country. They might just keep it to themselves.
Absolutely. That's true.
Because they don't want those criminals back in their their country. Okay, I want to thank you. I want to thank Polo for coming on. I want to thank Hal for coming on. And Rich Tracy is sitting in the corner. I want to thank him for coming in. And Chief, thanks for coming in and telling us what's going on down there. Appreciate it.
Sherry, happy to be here.
You too. Bye-bye.